Hello and welcome to the Student Playlist podcast, brought to you by thestudentplaylist.com. This is the 24th episode where we review the biggest and best new music released in May 2015. To start, here's a clip by Disclosure, Holding On.
Weight of love on my shoulders. I thought that it would be easier than this. I thought my heart had grown colder. But the warmth of your kiss I can't dismiss. My past has left deep bruises. I ain't hiding from the truth.
So that was the lead single from the new Disclosure album, as yet untitled, and doesn't have a release date yet, but it features Gregory Porter. Pretty funky stuff. Cecil, of course, was the one of the best albums of 2013, as far as I can remember. Completely reconfigured British dance music and took it out of the clutches of Calvin Harris for a bit and made sort of chart dance music likeable.
It'll be interesting to see whether they play as pivotal a role at the festivals this year, because I remember they were a real focal point at Glastonbury last year.
I don't think they've got many festival appearances coming up. They are curating one of their own in Brighton alongside Rudimental. Anyway, that'll be coming out in the next couple of months, presumably. So we'll definitely be reviewing that.
Okay. Other albums we will be reviewing today on the show with clips are Mumford & Sons, Wilder Mind, Brandon Flowers, The Desired Effect, The Vaccines, English Graffiti, and Hot Chip, Why Makes Sense. Other records that we may talk about today, but otherwise you can look out for on the site.
Got Chat About the Fall.
Yeah, are Palmer Violets, My Morning Jacket, Paul Weller, Django Django, Joanna Gruesome, Best Coast, The Tallest Man on Earth, God Damn, The Fall, Ash, Chastity Belt, Unknown Mortal Orchestra, Torres, The OCs, King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard.
That's a magnificent name.
Yeah. And Holly Herndon, finally, Mini Mansions.
Yeah, it's been a pretty busy month, as you can find, as you'll be able to figure out from that.
And after that, we'll be celebrating some big birthdays of classic albums. First off, Gorillaz with Demon Days, which was 10 years old on the 23rd of May.
I can't believe that's 10.
I know. Supergrass's I Should Coco, which was 20 years old on the 15th of May. And New Order's Low Life, which was 30 years old on the 13th of May. First off, the news.
Bit of news.
The Glastonbury lineup is finally complete.
Glastonbury lineup?
Glastonbury.
That sounds well cockney, that is.
I know.
So they announced The Who, because it's the 50th anniversary of The Who.
Ace. I think that's good. It was a nice surprise.
But things they had The Who in 2007, though, relatively recently. And Roger Daltrey was having difficulty singing then, so. And that was 8 years ago.
When you say having difficulty singing,
we can't really hit the high notes like he used to.
They'll probably just do a bit of electronic jiggery-pokery and make it sound good this year, though.
Well, the rumour was that there were going to be two sort of joint headliners on the Sunday, and the big rumour was it was going to be Blur and Oasis. That would have been amazing. And then there was another rumour which said Led Zeppelin, which actually would have been, you know, a great sort of surprise from the past. I was kind of feeling The Who's a little bit...
thought it was going to be Queen, honestly.
They already ruled themselves out months ago, like Fleetwood Mac did.
I must have missed that one.
Yeah, I was like, I was a while ago. But Emily Eavis has did an interview with The Times a few days ago saying she was getting death threats about Kanye West.
What?
I know.
What's the point of that?
Of course, there was that petition by that fan, a Glastonbury ticket holder, who put up a petition on change.org and wanted Kanye West's Glastonbury Saturday night headline spot cancelled. And it got 133,000 signatures. And then it turned out that the fan actually had never been to Glastonbury before.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah. And unsurprisingly, the guy was from Norfolk. So, anyway.
I just don't get that, because people are just...
It's different.
Taking Kanye West by all the stupid stuff he does.
Being Kanye.
Yeah, yeah. All the stuff that fills gossip columns. If you listen to his music, he's a solid artist. And if you've been to
his shows, he's
a great showman. Yeah. So,
he's
just
a controversial
sit back and
showman,
watch it, you fools.
Yeah. Well, Jay-Z blew everyone away in 2008. Who would bet against Kanye West? Who would bet against him doing the same? Yeah. An idiot, that's who. Anyway, albums time.
To start off, Mumford & Sons have released a new album, Wilder Mind.
This was quite a few weeks ago, wasn't it?
Yeah. We'll start with a clip, Snake Eyes.
It's a watertight excuse. It's in the eyes, I can tell you. Will always be there. We had it tonight. What do you want?
You just heard Snake Eyes from Mumford & Sons' new album, Wilder Mind. What did you make of this, Ed?
Well, as some of you will know, I'm not the biggest Mumford & Sons fan in the entire world. But this is at least sort of an interesting direction they've gone in. You can't have failed to notice by now that they've ditched the banjos, ditched the tweed, and the accordions, and the waistcoats. Banjoist Winston Marshall has said that he hates playing the instrument, and Marcus Mumford has said that their name is, quote, a pain in the arse.
Their name?
Yeah, yeah. Because it denotes folk when they can't. If they want to go in a different direction, they'll be lumbered with a name that denotes folk.
Right.
Right. And he's also said they want to, quote, freak people out. So what they've done is they've, you know, ditched the banjos and taken up electric guitars, synths and leather jackets. And they've aimed to make an arena rock album. Now, for such a big band to take a risk with their unique selling point in this way is admirable if you think about it. But as soon as you start listening to Wilder Mind, a couple of practical problems spring up very quickly. It's not really like a flinch from the spotlight that those quotes that Marcus Mumford has said would denote. They've not exactly shined away from making big festival music. If anything, this album sounds even bigger and even more mainstream orientated. That, you know, basically what they've done is they've caught the big music, and boy have they got it bad. This isn't something that they had to do, because that sound was already capable of filling huge spaces, wasn't it? I mean, anybody who's seen Mumford & Sons live will testify to that. But now, it seems that that facet of their sound, the capability of filling big spaces, has become the raison d'etre rather than like a happy side effect of it, if you know what I mean. It's like they've seeded the ground that they've already conquered, but they want to occupy the same territory all over again, only this time wearing different clothes. And if you listen to Believe, the lead single, it's just, aside from the kick drums, it may as well be Coldplay in all but name. And it's full of like languid guitar caresses and sort of instant drum and bass rhythms that will be familiar to any modern indie fan. But it's like a plain pizza bass with like no toppings on it. They've made themselves more anonymous by doing so. Marcus Mumford's lyrics are pretty much exactly the same as they always were. They rely on sweeping sentiment and platitudes rather than any kind of genuine biographical revelation. But this time, like, the scope of his voice is much more impressive. He's always been able to deliver like an eye-popping chorus, hasn't he? Sort of neck bulging. But now he's like developed a quieter side to it. He builds up to it from like a mutter, and that's probably the most interesting thing about Wilder Mind, is that his voice has greater scope. But his voice still has to do a lot of the heavy lifting on this record, and it doesn't always work. I mean, aside from Snake Eyes, which you heard, which is genuinely a really good song, there's a kind of a skeletal moment called Cold Arms, which is quite clearly going to be like the sign at all their live shows to go and get beer, basically. or Just Smoke. It sounds a bit like their origins. I just don't really know why they've done this. Perhaps they want to be loved by the critics this time. You know, having won over the people, now they want to win over the critics who were always quite sniffy about them in the past. But they've abandoned their unique selling point, and now they just sound a bit like everybody else. I mean, it won't anger anybody, but it's not going to satisfy anybody either.
Did it anger you?
Well, paradoxically, for all my complaints about it, this is the best album they've ever made. I mean, I think Drowned in Sound pointed out that, is this now what passes for ambition in British music? Just sounding like U2? While this is a failure on its own terms, because the only people that this is going to freak out are people who find Keane a bit too much, this is the best album they've ever made. If by best you mean least irritating. It's very formulaic, but it's a different formula, at least. So, 5 out of 10. It could have been much worse.
I think that's a fair review. Yeah. They said, you know, they want to. His quotes, he makes it sound like he wants to go against the grain, freak people out. But if you think about it, it's what Florence has done. She's, you know, ditched the kind of the folk hippie act, and she's, you know, taken on, you know, big riffs and stronger, more rocky singing. And Laura Marling, of course, has eschewed her more acoustic sound for electronic music. Or, you know,
or guitar music, electric guitar music. Yeah, yeah, she's not gone synth.
No. Oh, God, imagine that. That's going to be the next one.
Yeah.
All right, then. What about Brandon Flowers and his album, The Desired Effect?
Ugh.
Wait. Okay, let's play a clip. His Lonely Town. Spinning like a gravitron when I was just a kid. I always thought that things would change, but they never did. Spinning like when I was just a kid, I always thought that things would change, but they never did. I'm hanging on to the end of this rope, somewhere on the outskirts of... Lonely Town there by Brandon Flowers from his new album, The Desired Effect.
Right.
Is it as good as his solo debut?
Well, that was a very dull album, Flamingo. Basically, The Killers have always been like the world's best karaoke band. I mean, we talked about Hot Fuss last year. You know, that's still a great album.
Mm.
But ever since, they've been kind of rummaging through the dressing up box of rock and pop history to find sort of various different disguises for each of their four albums. You know, you had New Wave Brandon with Hot Fuss. Then you had Springsteen Brandon with Sam's Town. Then you had Glam Pop Brandon on Day and Age. And then you had Bono Brandon on Battleborn. So... this comes 3 years after the last Killers album, and it's another solo record. I mean, what are the Killers doing? You know, 2010, Flamingo added absolutely nothing to Flowers' skill set whatsoever.
It revealed
absolutely nothing new about him to us that we didn't already know. It was Sam's Town by other means.
Yes, yeah, I'd agree with that, but it was very enjoyable.
But this is, solo albums are supposed to reveal something about an artist to us that we didn't already know. So, in terms of revelation, there's very little of this on The Desired Effect. It's a little bit better than Flamingo, but not by much. He's brought in a producer called Ariel Rechtscheid, I think how you pronounce it. He produced Haim and Vampire Weekend, and a number of pop artists as well. And what he's done is to take sort of the highly produced end of the 80s, as its template. Basically, what you need to is think Day and Age. That's kind of the thing that he's channeling this time. The producer's taken all sort of the surface elements of that shiny 80s sound and sort of buffed them up, made them very shiny, and accentuated everything. Everything is kind of surface on this record, like the gated drums, the synth pads, the piano and keyboards sort of that twinkle and, you know, little flourishes everywhere. And sort of touches of extremely overblown guitar histrionics is what we're dealing with here. But I have to say, you do get a little glimpse of the real Brandon Flowers through all the smoke and mirrors on this record. On a song called I Can Change, it samples Small Town Boy by Bronski Beat, who are in famous one-hit wonders from the 80s, and it's got Pet Shop Boys' Neil Tennant on guest vocals.
Cool.
But the lyric goes, when you're out of luck, I'll be what you're looking for, even if it's not who I am. I can change for you, I can bend, I can break, I can shift, I can shape. And so this is a portrait of Brandon Flowers as a blank canvas. He will be whatever you want him to be. You can project whatever you want onto him. And I reckon this is the secret to the Killer's success. It's what you bring to the table. When he's not playing at being a pop star, he is a blank canvas. He's everything that you want him to be. So it's all artifice, but it does at least show you probably what Flowers' heart is. He's somebody who isn't comfortable unless he's dressed in someone else's clothes. But, you know, like I said, even as he's doing this, he's still speaking in the language of another. He's not comfortable showing us his soul, like I said. And it begs the question, are his songs interesting enough for us to bother trying? And it's an okay album, but there's nothing really to write home about. It's heroically flawed, just like every Killers album. A little bit overdramatic in its widescreen ambitions. When it's minimal, it's surprisingly effective. There's a number of songs, particularly in the middle, like I Can Change and Lonely Town, where he's quieter, more reflective, and it works a little bit better. But he still trips him. He trips over himself with his eagerness to please on a number of occasions. There's an absolutely terrible song called "Digging Up the Heart," which sounds just like Springsteen and ELO. He just can't resist a little bit of desert rock, even amongst all sort of the shiny 80s-ness of it. The opening track, it's got these really terrible, tacky-sounding keyboard preset trumpets all over it. It's very plasticky. There's a lot of emptiness underneath the shiny surfaces here, but he is still an undeniably enthusiastic portrait painter and storyteller, even if he is just sort of sticking to the whole Teenage Runaways themes that he's always stuck to with Killers songs. And to the extent that it holds together at all, it seems to be entirely by his own willpower to make it work. So it's a little bit flimsy, a little bit tacky, but Killers fans will love it. I mean, it's at number one at the moment. It's not selling badly at all. Beat Paul Weller to number one. It suffers from the same problem that all Killers albums do, effectively. He's not really telling us that much new about himself. So 5 out of 10.
Okay. Any word on the new Killers stuff?
Well, he seems to be... He gave an interview recently where he said they find it difficult to all get together on the same page, and that he doesn't anticipate anything happening for at least another year.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. It could be at least 2017 by the time we have any new Killers material, I'd say.
Won't hold our breath then.
No.
Well, what about the Vaccines now?
Ooh.
Homegrown talent. They've got a new album, English Graffiti. And here's the clip, 2020. "2020" there by the Vaccines from their new album English Graffiti. Ed, did the song make you see clearly?
Lol. Good segue there. It's better than I thought it was going to be honest. I mean, like many bands after two albums, the Vaccines have got like an existential question mark hanging over their heads. They found tremendous success with what was the first album called? What did you expect from the Vaccines?
Yeah.
And then Coming of Age was the second one. But they followed very closely after each other, so they've pretty much completed 3.5 years of relentless touring to get to this point, and then they needed a break, so they're knackered and now they need to come up with a new direction. It's a quandary that has done for quite a lot of successful bands in the past, like Kaiser Chiefs, Razorlight, Futureheads. But Justin Young, the lead singer, has already come out and said that he intends this album to age badly. They've called it stylized pop. They brought in a guy called Dave Fridman to produce, who fans of sort of US indie will recognise as the producer of Mercury Rev, Flaming Lips, and I think he did the last MGMT album.
Yeah.
Which is an extremely odd match on paper, because what Fridman usually does when he produces records is to pick one instrument out of the mix and like distort it and accentuate it at the expense of all the other instruments that are present, often including the vocalist at times. So what he's picked here is Freddie Cowan's guitar to sort of make front and centre, like the star of the show. And it kind of works, but it makes a lot of the ideas that don't work sound very helium light and sort of very sort of featherweight. They kind of slide out of the memory as soon as they finished. I mean, what you get is a kind of a tongue-in-cheek, parenthesized, sort of in quotation marks version of the Vaccines, kind of an ironic Vaccines. It starts off in pretty safe territory with a song called Handsome, which has already come out, which is a Ramones sort of pop-punk nugget that they've been doing their entire career, although it is a bit sparser and a bit more judicious in its use of noise, and it's very direct. And then we go quite obtuse and ironic with Dream Lover, which was what we briefly listened to last time.
Brilliant.
Sounded
brilliant song.
By far and away the best thing on the album. Probably the best thing they've ever done, I'd say. Absolutely magnificent riff, and the lyric is very cold, and it reflects like the Vaccines theme on the album, like disconnection and atomization in 2015. And the lyric goes, "With a hollow embrace, let's go back to your place."
Yeah.
But that's quite an obtuse and oblique kind of version of the Vaccines. It sounds a bit It just sounds different. But as the album wears on, it's characterised by songs that sound like they could do with a bit more work structurally, made interesting by some very heavily processed guitar. Like I said, Freddie Cowan's guitar is the star of the show. And on the song called Radio Bikini, where the guitars actually sound like those laser toy guns that you used to have when you were kids. You know, they just sound very... They buzz, and they're very highly processed. And it's to the expense of the bass and the drums, which sound a little bit light, and even Justin Young's voice, which is not particularly comprehensible at times.
Wow.
And there's a slump in the middle of the record. It's populated by some rather strange rock ballads that sound a bit like The Cure or John Lennon. And it ends rather sort of abruptly with kind of a 1.5 minute instrumental that's got backwards guitars and nothing else. It's like, oh, was that it? So luckily for it, it's got one absolute stonker on it, Dream Lover, which will sort of keep people coming back to it. It sounds like a space age version of Arctic Monkeys, Do I Want to Know, with all like the Queen and Muse theatrics everywhere. If it had some better songs, particularly towards the end, it would be much more interesting. And for all the great production, it's fundamentally covering up a lack of genuinely good songs, like the first two albums had. So it's a qualified success, because at least they're actually trying to do something different, and that is to their credit. But it'll be interesting to see what Vaccines fans make out of this, because I can very easily see it being an opinion splitter. It'll probably make number one, but who knows what it'll do afterwards. It will also do nothing to convert sort of the people who were cynical about them in the first place.
I don't know, because I was cynical about them, and then of course Dream Lovers had a lot of airplay in the past few weeks
everywhere on TV.
And it's brilliant. It's a new light on a band that I thought I got worked out the first time around. I really enjoy it, so maybe I think it's more of a spend the 99p, go on iTunes, get the single, but maybe, you know, the album's not it's not a vintage buy.
It's a platform for them to build from, but I hope that it won't sort of make them slide out of view in the meantime, because this can very easily happen. It's such a fast moving industry now. So, you know, actually quite liked it in many places. I've got at least a lot of respect for the Vaccines for doing something different. So 6 out of 10. So
great stuff. And finally, of the set this week.
Yeah, lots of British things this week.
Hot Chip, remember them?
Been together for 11 years.
That's crazy. But their new album's called Why Makes Sense. And we'll start with a clip, Cry For You. There with Cry For You from their new album Why Make Sense.
Does
it make sense?
I think it's one of the best things they've done for quite a while, to be honest. Who would have guessed they've been around for as long as they have? They've just been very quietly getting on with their career. I mean, they seem to have accumulated a very impressive arsenal of like great singles and interesting albums without anybody really noticing. I'm surprised they've lasted this long, because bands with this many creative people, Alexis Taylor's got his own solo career, Joe Goddard, of course, is in the Two Bears, who've done a number of albums by themselves, and Al Doyle and Felix Martin did an album at the end of last year called New Build together. So bands with that many creative outlets tend to go in different directions after a while. So it shows that they're at least, you know, they're all still together for the love of the music. So what they're trying to do is continue like the warm live feel that their last album In Our Heads in 2012 had, and for my money that was their most consistent, if perhaps not their best album. They sought to continue that feeling of you listening to sort of deep cuts all the time, you know, getting really exploring the house side of it rather than the pop side. This time they've infused it with just like the vaguest sense of like dread about life in 2015. It's never explicitly stated, but it kind of overhangs the record. It doesn't feel like you're listening to a hangover, but it kind of feels like they might have had hangovers while recording it. It feels kind of grumpy and not... But it's everything you've come to expect from a Hot Chip album over the years. Sleek, light-footed house with licks of guitar and funk everywhere. and by and large it works. Sometimes sort of the beat is very fractious and fidgety, like on Love Is the Future and Need You Now, which was a single that was recently released. Sometimes it's very warm and ambient, like on the Cry For You, which we just heard. And sometimes they even go a bit Stevie Wonder, get, you know, really deep down funky with it. So Easy to Get and Started Right. You know that sort of clavichord sound that they have on Superstition?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that's on them, Started Right. But as is now traditional with Hot Chip albums, there's a distinct dip mid-record, which kind of ruins the whole thing, because it's nearly a great album, but it isn't. And that has been the problem with at least four Hot Chip albums now that I can think of. Two songs back to back called White Wine and Fried Chicken and Dark Night. The first one is a really badly judged slow jam, and the other is just totally phoned in, like they just couldn't be arsed with it at all. But it does finish with a really startling title track that actually recalls F Buttons. Remember, we saw them at Live at Leeds?
Oh, yeah.
Like really loud and sort of very repetitious. So it's got the same problems that Hot Chip albums always had. And they've come so close to making their masterpiece on so many occasions now that you wonder if they're not just doing it deliberately, just to mess with our heads. But the truth is, they just love experimenting, and often it makes them sort of colour outside the lines a bit or run with an idea that doesn't really work properly. But it does mean that when the best of Hot Chip comes out, as it probably will in the near future, it's going to be the best compilation ever. The edited highlights of the Hot Chip albums are amazing, all put together. And it's no bad thing, because basically what we're left with is another sort of charmingly imperfect Hot Chip album, just like all the others. So, 7 out of 10.
Charmingly imperfect. I think that sums up Hot Chip altogether.
Yeah, they're like the Coral, actually. The Coral came so close to making their own masterpiece on many occasions.
But they burned out.
Yeah.
Hot Chip is still delivering, in a way.
So that's all the albums, but we've got little brief ones now.
Okay, do you want to say anything about Palmer Violets and their new album, Danger in the Club?
Same problem as the last one. The songs just aren't that good, despite all the attitude.
What about My Morning Jacket with The Waterfall?
7 out of 10. Nearly as good as Zed, their masterpiece from 10 years ago.
Wow. Paul Weller, Saturn's Pattern.
Matt Review, this gave it 7. Different direction for the Modfather this time. It's longer songs and fewer of them, rather than sort of that punk sound that he's been channeling for the last 5 years or so. Yeah, nice evolution. Shows that he's still got plenty of creativity left.
Joanna Gruson, Peanut Butter.
This is a 21-minute long album that Matt reviewed. 6 out of 10. I liked it more than he did.
Are all the songs short?
Yeah, very sort of. There's 10 songs on it, so you know, work that out. Sort of 2.5 minutes at most.
Interesting. Yeah. Best Coast, California Nights.
I wish this was better than it was. I wish this was good as Crazy For You, but it isn't. Matt reviewed it, gave it 6.
The Tallest Man on Earth, Dark Bird Is Home.
Probably the least brilliant album he's done so far. Fundamentally enjoyable, 7 out of 10.
Goddamn, Vultures.
Have you heard of this band? They're from Wolverhampton, and sort of, they're very much your sort of music. I really enjoyed this album. I gave it 8 out of 10.
They surfaced a few years ago.
Yeah,
like
this is their
2012.
This is their debut. They just supported the Foo Fighters, actually.
Right. But, okay.
A really good album. 8 out of 10.
The Fall, Sublingual Tablet.
Ooh,
I know you're excited about this one.
This firmly belongs in the bottom third of their back catalogue. I'm really quite disappointed with it. Oh. Bit phoned in. My review's on the site, and I will update my comprehensive full list in the next few days, so put it in the great list of their 31st album.
Whoa. Ash Kablamo !!
Do you remember Ash?
Everyone loves Ash.
This is actually surprisingly good. I thought this was going to be, you know, kind of just one more for the fans sort of thing, but really good. 7 out of 10.
Great. Chastity Belt, Time To Go Home.
Very interesting sort of Sleater Kinney like sort of American northwestern punk, but kind of mixed with that. Do you remember we really liked Real Estate last year? That came very highly on our list. It sounds a bit more sort of relaxed, less frenetic, but gives the ideas time to be. Really enjoyed this album. 8 out of 10.
Unknown Mortal Orchestra, Multi Love.
Haven't reviewed it yet. Matt is going to do it in the next few days. And the same with
Torres, Sprinter, same there. Yeah. What about the OCs, Mutilated, Defeated, At Last?
Ninth album in 9 years from John Dwyer. Matt reviewed it 6 out of 10. I think I liked it better than he did, though.
Why?
Different. It's darker and more subdued. I mean, Floating Coffin got them a lot of press like 2 years ago. This isn't as good as that, though. Anyway.
And what about the wonderfully titled King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard with their album Quarters?
This sounds very much like your thing, to be honest. Sounds a bit like Pond. It's called Quarters because it's 40 minutes and 40 seconds long, and there are four tracks, each divided into 10 minutes, 10 seconds.
Are there four people in the band?
Yes, I think so.
Wow.
Good.
That's carefully good. Thought out.
Yeah.
nearly there. Holly Herndon with Platform.
Matt reviewed this, gave it 9 out of 10, and it's coming from Matt. 9 out of 10 is a big praise, you know.
What kind of stuff is it?
It's kind of electronica, but kind of folky as well.
That pretty much describes everything of the past 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, I can't recall exactly what he said, but I heard it. It was very haunting, kind of like Grimes, but a bit more vocally. Yeah, give it a listen. It's a really fascinating album.
Interesting.
And I should say the last one, Mini Mansions, mm-hmm. came out in March, and I completely missed it, but I absolutely loved it.
Oh, really?
And yeah,
nine
out of 10. For a Queens of the Stone Age side project, it absolutely knocks them Crooked Vultures into a cocked hat, I'd say.
Really?
Them Crooked Vultures was lumbering and...
No. Them Crooked Vultures were brilliant.
5 out of 10. I gave that album, or would have done. Yeah. Didn't like it at all. Too many cooks ruining the broth on that one.
I would disagree.
This
Good.
Is.
I still enjoy listening to it now.
Mini Mansions features Brian Wilson and Alex Turner.
Wow.
Yeah. Good guest vocals. Anyway.
Well, that's the album's list rattled through, but as usual, keep your eye on the site for new stuff coming in daily, where Ed will offer his opinion on everything, as he enjoys doing.
I think we should probably say at this point that this is your last ever show, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm moving to Hong Kong, so...
What are you going to do in Hong Kong?
I'm going to work as a sub-editor at a newspaper.
What newspaper?
The South China Morning Post.
The biggest English language circulation paper in the world, I think you said?
Certainly the most profitable.
Wow. So, yeah, moving onwards and upwards. And I need a new presenter now. Someone who'll put up with my rantings. Otherwise it's just going to be me in a microphone and no one wants that.
Mail all your auditions to PO Box.
Nah, we'll find somebody.
Though seriously, if you want to get involved, give him a tweet.
Oh yeah, please do. At the student playlist.
Yeah. Classic albums time. Time to sing happy birthday to some albums celebrating big birthdays that we don't want to forget. First off, Gorilla's Demon Days. So this is mad.
I know.
Because I think that Feel Good Inc. may have been the first single I ever bought. I can't remember if it was Feel Good Inc. or Weezer's Beverly Hills. Because they sort of came out around the same time, and I remember being in HMV and buying the single when I was about 13 or 12 or something.
Wow.
Yeah.
Age difference here.
But
this came out just before I went to uni for the first time.
Wow. Yeah. So it could well have been. But anyway, it was 10 years old on the 23rd of May. While you reminisce and freak out about the whole age thing, we've got two clips: Last Living Souls and Dare. Of clips there to get you in the mood from Gorilla's decade-old album Demon Days.
I know, it's slightly unnerving because, like I just said, it came out a couple of years before I went to uni. Everybody, of course, is going to remember Feel Good Inc. With that windmill video, sort of the Hayao Miyazaki sort of channeling sort of anime feel to it. And Dare, obviously, because that was a UK number one single. Aside from it just being a good album, a great album, I would argue this album actually helped to shape where pop music is today. It certainly defined Damon Albarn as a solo artist outside of Blur, helped him find his feet. And it launched Danger Mouse's sort of legit mainstream career, because before that he was famous for doing the Grey album, which, if you remember, was a mix of Jay-Z's Black album and the Beatles' White album, sort of mixed together. In like, it was like a totally illegal bootleg. But on the back of it, Albarn hired him and helped sort of launch him as a legitimate thing. And yeah, like I said, it's just an exquisitely realised pop album. Danger Mouse, whose real name is Brian Burton, really brings Albarn's sort of sense of foreboding and sort of dread post 9/11 to the record. But the concept is not overbearing. It kind of percolates and underscores the music with like these deep chasms of dub that you can hear on Last Living Souls. It's very sparsely organised. Everything is exactly where it needs to be, but it doesn't sound mechanical as a result. It's a really strange sort of chemistry. If you can remember the first Gorillaz album from 2001, that was... It kind of felt like a studio project with a unique selling point attached to it. It kind of felt theoretical, like on paper. And it didn't help that, you know, Clint Eastwood and 19-2000 had to be remixed in order to actually hit the charts. This time round, it's a lot more commercially orientated, and Gorillaz really do feel much more like a real thing rather than just... like I said, a laboratory project.
Yeah.
The album's got a really cinematic scope to it, which does reflect sort of the post-apocalyptic sort of theme of the album. That kind of, not only is the future rushing towards us at a rate of knots, it may also spell our doom. That's kind of the sense that you feel. Do you remember that Fire Coming Out of the Monkey's Head? That sort of the Dennis Hopper spoken word one. That was totally bizarre, but it's kind of like central to the album. It was about how people live with nature and like how, you know, if you mess around with natural resources, Mother Nature will sort of punish you. And that theme is what Damon Albarn has been doing ever since, you know, with Everyday Robots, with The Good, the Bad and the Queen, Dr. D and Monkey, you know, the musicals.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, with this album, you've got the guest stars who are all amazing. You've got Roots Maneuver, MF Doom from Mad Villain, De La Soul, Naina Cherry, Booty Brown from The Far Side, Ike Turner, Sean Ryder, obviously, and like we said, Dennis Hopper turns up to sort of just say some strange words about, you know, sort of happy folk and strange people, isn't it? And they all turn in, you know, brilliantly realised contributions which are totally suited to their genres. And finally, you've got the four fantastic singles from it. Three of which were UK top 10, Dirty Harry, the third one, Dare, obviously, which was number one, and Feel Good Inc., which has the auspicious title of being the only Damon Albarn penned song ever to hit the US top 40.
Wow. Is that true?
Yeah. No Blur song ever made.
I did not know that.
So, despite the concept, it's not like this ponderous, like, sub OK Computer trudge. It's, the songs are really sort of nimble and flexible, aren't they? Like, and light on their feet, which means that it's a really enjoyable listen, and you feel clever listening to it in a way, because it's really sophisticated.
And it's
pop.
One of those albums that it's always fun to revisit, because whenever you hear it, it takes you back to that point to 2005.
I know.
And it always, on each listen, it has something different to offer.
Did you like Plastic Beach 5 years later?
Took them a while to make it. Not as much.
There were too many cooks spoiling the broth on that one. Like, the star guests on that one were even... like, Lou Reed and Marquis Smith were on it.
Bobby Womack, of course.
Yeah. That had the same kind of themes as this, but it kind of stretched it a little bit too far.
Yeah. Not as much of a fan, but...
Yeah. So, of course, Albarn did, like we said, The Good, Bad and the Queen, Everyday Robots, a new Blur album. They all have the same themes as this. Danger Mouse, a.k.a. Brian Burton... About a year later, he had the massive hit single Crazy with Gnarls Barkley, which uses exactly the same production techniques as this, you know, R&B, but really sort of cold and sparsely produced. Then, of course, he did Broken Bells with James Mercer from The Shins. And he got high-profile production jobs on albums by The Rapture, Beck, U2, Red Hot Chili Peppers, ASAP Rocky, and four Black Keys albums.
Oh, and that that Daniele Lupi album he did. Do you remember that?
Yeah, vaguely.
Yeah, that was brilliant.
And the album itself, it had an influence on the Go Team, Golf Rap, Black Keys, obviously, and just an awful lot of chart music that's come in the 10 years since. I think it's a really influential album on pop music as a genre, not on that many specific artists, but it's one of the cleverest pop albums in recent memory.
Okay. Secondly, we're going to talk about Supergrass and their album I Should Coco, which was 20 years old on the 15th of May.
Cockney rhyming slang for I should think so, apparently. That's where that comes from. Yeah. Anyway, clips of Caught by the Fuzz and the song you definitely know,
The Fuzz.
All Right.
Clips there from Supergrass's album I Should Coco, which is now 20 years old plus a week or two.
Supergrass are often overlooked when it comes to like the Britpop pantheon. I always think people always rattle off Oasis, Blur, Pulp, Elastica, Suede, but Supergrass unfairly overlooked a lot of the time.
Maybe because they were never as trendy. That's my theory.
Oh, they were definitely trendy.
I don't know.
This was nominated for the Mercury Prize. It was very fashionable at the time, made number one. Not only is I Should Coco one of the last truly excellent debuts of that era, I mean, 1995 Britpop was already becoming a bit stale, it's also hard to think of a more fun debut than this in the last 20 years. I mean, the singles on it alone are worth the purchase price. You got Man Size Rooster, Lenny, Lose It, Time, Caught by the Fuzz, All Right, I'd Like to Know. It's just a dazzling array of, sort of hit singles. It was just absolutely stripped bare of potential chart hits. But 20 years later, the things that really stand out are it's the power of Gaz Coombs' songwriting, I think. It's so sharp and well-developed for a guy who was barely out of his teens.
Yeah.
But there's also much more depth than an album constructed in this way might suggest, because I Should Coco is basically 13 songs dispatched at breakneck speed. Usually these things don't age very well, but you get a hint of like the darkness that would start creeping into their work for like with their next album, In It For The Money, which came out in 1997. For My Money, a slightly better album than this. There's a song called Sofa of My Lethargy at the end. It's sort of 6 minute and very different to all the rest of the songs on this record, because it's acoustically based, and where the rest of the album was a party, that song is a hangover after the end of the party, and it happens right at the end of the album, so it also balances together very well, the album. But for the most part, you just get precision targeted pop missiles, just like Supergrass are really good at, fizzing with like 60s beat and 70s punk energy, and it just sounds like the giddy, irresponsible sort of innocence of youth sort of encapsulated perfectly in 40 minutes. And of course it houses Supergrass's most famous song. It's called All Right, which you heard a clip of. It's just so recognisable and distinctive. And you've got that major minor key shift between like the bridge and the chorus. So I think it works really well, because even though it's celebrating youth, it's also sort of acknowledging its fleeting nature. So it's got wistfulness even amongst the partying.
Yeah.
It's a very clever sort of layering that I think really separates it from a lot of identikit work that was going on at the same time in British music. So, as time wore on, Supergrass became known as something of a singles band. I mean, the 2004 compilation that they released with all their singles, and it's absolutely to die for, that record. And it's brilliant. But that reputation, in my opinion, unfairly masks how varied and solid their albums were throughout their career. They made five more albums after this, and they eventually called it a day in 2008 with what's their last one? It's called Diamond Hoo Ha, I think. They were not as famous by then, you know, their commercial peak had long since gone, but they were still writing really mature, sophisticated pop music. So this is where it all started. Just a fantastic debut.
Lastly, we're going to talk about New Order's Low Life, which was 30 years old on the 13th of May. Two clips here, The Perfect Kiss and Elegia. It may be pronounced Elegia, we're not sure.
Yeah.
But you just heard a couple of clips from New Order's Low Life album, which is now 30 years old.
Well, remember we talked about Technique beginning of last year, one of the very first podcasts we did. This is my joint favourite New Order album along with that. It was their third album in total, and it signalled the completion of the transition that New Order made from the band that they were... just after Joy Division and Ian Curtis's suicide. New Order released Movement in 1981, which is understandably very morose and introspective and sort of shy album that, you know, had some problems with it, was fundamentally solid. And then they became the dance rock behemoth that they were by the end of the 80s, and Low Life signalled the end of that transition process. Yeah, their sound went from sort of gloomy Mancunian cityscapes to like the high energy pulses and beats of New York dance floors in the space of 4 years. And you end up with Low Life, which is a pretty much perfect fusion of rock and electronics that was miles ahead of its time in 1985. The foundations for this were set up with a single the previous year called Confusion, for which they hooked up with the famous electro producer Arthur Baker, who had helped produce you know, like electro and hip hop at the end of the 70s and the early 80s. That single, as its title denotes, was rather chaotic and sort of higgledy piggledy, but it was fun. But a year later, they had refined that idea into like a coherent template for a whole album. Like the one you just heard on that clip, The Perfect Kiss, is an absolutely perfect illustration of just how good they were at fusing together guitars and electronics. Sometimes on this album they kind of explore rock by itself. There's an opening track called Love Vigilantes, which is a bit of an oddity in New Order's back catalogue, because it sees Bernard Sumner being unusually direct in his lyrics. Usually he's very cryptic, and he tells the story of a soldier who comes home from his leave, and his wife thinks he's dead because he's got a mistaken telegram. Sometimes they explore electronica by itself. The clip you just heard, Elegia, we can't figure out how to pronounce
Elegia.
It. Yeah, it's 5 minutes on the album, but it had to be edited down from a 17 and a half original.
Wow.
Which you can find on the double CD reissue, which I have, obs. But for the most part, the songs are just very beautifully realised hybrids of dance and rock. You got Bernard Sumner's economical guitar chords, Peter Hook's fluid and quite loud bass lines, intersecting perfectly with Gillian Gilbert and Stephen Morris in the rhythm section, providing these seamless electronica drums and programming bits. Subculture, This Time of Night, Face Up are really great examples, but the best is the clip that you heard, Perfect Kiss, a spectacularly dramatic 9-minute workout on the single version. and whose his video was directed by Jonathan Demme, who 4 years later did Silence of the Lambs.
Interesting.
It's quite a moving video. It's just, it's quite a monochrome and nocturnal album, Low Life. It not much about it suggests colour or light or daytime even, but they're still very lively songs. It's not depressing in any way. It suggests like late night passion and emotions powered by sort of hormonal or chemical rushes. And it was one of, to my mind, only two occasions in New Order's career where their creativity matched their vision on an album, and Technique from 1989 was the other. Often sort of one aspect would sort of overcome the other and sort of overpower the mix. You know, they'd have too many ideas for them to realise all in one record. It would just be some muddles, or they just didn't have enough ideas, like on particularly some of their later records. But by this time, New Order were generally at home on the 12-inch single format, which is why New Order compilations are like amazing things. Their singles were absolutely bulletproof, brilliant, except for Touched by the Hand of God, which is rubbish. So it's, in terms of influence, it is impossible to understand the Pet Shop Boys, who released their first album the year after this. You can't understand the Eurythmics without them. And Into the Noughties, The Killers, Brandon Flowers and Hot Chip. You can't really, they wouldn't have sounded the same if New Order hadn't done it first. So that is the effect that New Order had on the 80s. They were such a rich seam of influence for people, even 20 years later, to carry on mining.
That's lovely. I think that's a perfect note to end it on. Wrapping the day's reviews up neatly with a legendary album.
It is a legendary album, actually.
Okay, so in the June edition in a month's time...
Which you won't be
no,
on.
No, you'll have to net someone else to do it. But Ed will be reviewing In Depth, Florence and the Machine, Slaves, Muse, Whoop Whoop, Wolf Alice and Years and Years. Meanwhile, on the site, make sure you look out for Sun Kill Moon, Soak, Jamie XX, ASAP Rocky, Major Lazer, Left Field, FFS, Everything of Monsters and Men, Sarah Cracknell, Gengar, Hudson Mohawk and Active Child.
Who are FFS?
Franz Ferdinand and the Sparks.
Sarah Cracknell is also the lead singer of Saint Etienne, for reference. But I know you can't wait for FFS.
It's
such a great thing on paper.
I had tickets to see them.
Oh, no.
Damn it. So, get the birthday candles out for these albums over the next 4 weeks. Coldplay's X and Y.
I know.
That's crazy. 10 years old. The Verve's A Northern Soul. Chemical Brothers' Exit Planet Dust. And Bjork's Post, which will all be 20 years old. Plus, there'll be other features on the site about R.E.M., The Cribs, Neil Young, Sonic Youth, Sleater-Kinney, and The Birds, who all released great albums that are worth celebrating. So, please do keep in touch with us on the website, of course, thestudentplaylist.com, on Twitter at studentplaylist, and Facebook.
Yeah, I need to do some work on Facebook.
get promoting. Yeah. So we're at that stage where there's only one thing left for Ed to pick his album of the month.
Well,
or top three albums of the month, should I say.
I mean, we're a bit of an odd situation this week because none of what I've picked we actually covered in depth because they're all sort of fives and sixes this time. I'd say third place, Goddamn with Vultures, which is a very intelligent sort of mix of post-punk and metal that... I'm generally not a metal fan, and Kerrang have been championing this band like crazy, and usually that turns me off. But fantastic album. Second place, Chastity Belt with Time to Go Home. We gave that 8 out of 10. But there's only one clear winner: Holly Herndon's Platform, which Matt gave 9 out of 10. Really spooky and genuinely moving album. There's been a lot of sixes and sevens this month, but not many eights and nines. It's been that kind of a month. Yeah, there's a really good feature about her on NPR, which is an American sort of public radio website. Which, if you want to know anything more about her, it's just you go and get. But yeah, album of the month, Holly Herndon, Platform.
Great.
And so it's goodbye, Lauren.
Thank you all for listening. And
I would have put together a montage of her best bits, but I didn't have enough time.
It's fine. Let's save.
There were some sweeping strings over it.
Oh, no, don't. Oh, I'm going to miss you. I'm going to miss you all.
What are we going to do?
Goodbye and good luck. Best wishes. Bye.
Bye.